y'all have it?
Mm-hmm. I had an actually interesting kind of funny experience. I go to Carleton, and I was in a class, and I kept playing with my, I often sit cross-legged, and I was playing with my pebble in my sock, and the professor noticed, and he said, you know, Saskia, you asked me a question on that. Of course, I was thinking of the hate antidote, because I was thinking about classes and whatever else, and so of course, I had no idea what he was talking about, unfortunately, because my mind is somewhere else completely, but
the pebble's supposed to make you aware that you're in
trouble. So that was an odd moment.
So what did you do?
I said I have a rock in my sock that's
which was sort of jerk. You didn't mention that you put it there. Did he sympathize or say take it out?
It was a funny moment because I was sitting there.
Well, was it a pebble or a rock?
It was a small rock.
Oh, you really went for it, did you?
Well, I started off with a small pebble, and then I got used to that very quickly. It's the same thing that you
did. Isn't that interesting?
So, yeah. Well, I find that in the beginning I was thinking about it constantly, and then it just sort of... Then I got used to it and stopped, and then I picked up a bigger stone on the way and put it in my sock, which also raised some looks. But in campus walking, putting frogs in my sock. So it was all a very interesting private little experience. But,
and what else happened with it when you put?
Well, it did evoke the thoughts, you know, because I'd done the meditation in the morning, and so I thought about the practice and what thoughts it should evoke, and
what it was meant to remind you of, why you put it there. Yeah.
Yeah, and so it just constantly brought me back into the moment. It was a useful exercise, I thought.
It is useful, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if it's going to be something I'll keep up. Yeah. Or if I will just get used to the rock.
But you can switch things, too. I mean, I got one of those watches at one time that went ding every hour. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're annoying as I'll get out to everybody else. But for me, every time it went ding, I would do whatever mantra I was focusing on. This is not mine, this I have not, this is not myself. Or may I be well and happy as I am, may all beings be. Whatever. And that I found that very interesting, because after a day and a half of it, when it went ding at night, I would be doing that. Because once I woke up, and it had just gone ding, and I was doing it. A couple of times that happened, and I woke up and just caught. Oh, yeah. Interesting. And habit is the number one way that rebirth thinking karma is formed. So the way you usually think is what you're interfering with. Did any of you notice that what your usual pattern was because it was being interrupted? You did? What was your usual pattern?
Think of what I'm supposed to be doing.
Going into the future.
Going into the future.
Yeah. And then it would get interrupted.
Yep.
That's very valuable. That's very valuable. You say something to me about the negative?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I played around with what shoe it was in. And it was a difference what shoe it was in, actually. Mm-hmm. And I can feel very sorry for myself when it was in my left shoe. Very, very sorry for myself. Sad stories. I'm telling myself. And continually catching that mind that's going through the things that I was doing today. I mean, I wasn't on retreat. I was sitting at my desk. I was working, and it was, you know, it's a it's a mindset, especially when it was in the right ship. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, it's just like, and it's not really fast, it's just, it's almost like grinding through things, and it can be very exhausting. Yeah, it felt like a mill, like a grinder.
Mm-hmm. So with the Pebble, did that give you moments to just sort of be where you were, mm-hmm, as well? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Was that
I just sort of catch
useful?
It and just...
Did you find that useful?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to have a Pebble on my shoe all the time.
You know. Maybe a watch that goes ding. Or it goes ding every 3 hours. Or a reminder on your computer that pops up every 3 hours. Can't you do that with those calendars?
You can do that in Outlook.
You can put a little note in every 3 hours or something. You just go ding. And just put a question mark for your message. Mm-hmm. Mm. So it goes ding, question mark comes up, and you go, right, where am I?
Yeah.
Drop it.
That's a great idea.
If you're working on a computer, it's right there. A Pebble is just a quick way in a day to really understand how much you're not here. When you recognize that, you can start to actually decide that you want to be here and take a more subtle way. And it's your choice then, you see. It's your choice. You can either do it or not, but it's always there. There's always a possibility. If you start introducing those a little moment, 3 or 4 times a day, that little moment will make a very big difference in your energy overall, in your sense of clutter, in your sense of never getting anywhere, because you're always trying to get here. Getting everything done means that you can be here. So if you give yourself little moments of here, you don't get so... There's always another project. You're always in the middle. Born in the middle, you die in the middle. It's always the middle. But I should be here and start to experience what, who else of you is here and what here feels like. It's very rare in our lives. Nobody else is going to give you permission. You're the only one who can grant this to yourself. You know, you're the only one. And are you going to be kind enough to give yourselves your own life? It's the only person who can do it. It doesn't matter who loves you, how well they love you. It doesn't matter how great your teacher is. It doesn't matter any of those things. This one's yours. And if you're not here, you can't learn anything new. And if you can't learn anything new, life gets more and more repetitive. If life gets more and more repetitive, you start feeling trapped. Start wishing that that would save you, or that would save you, and you start having greater and greater fantasies about somewhere else. And that makes you less and less here. Mm-hmm. If you're not here, you don't have any power. Simple.
There was something that concerned me in this exercise about what I perceive about myself. Is, okay, I had this little rock in my shoe. I could feel it. And it was sort of like, okay, it's there. I'll tolerate it. This is how I feel about life. I tolerate it.
Isn't that nice to see? Isn't that nice to see? see, that's what I'm saying, habitual patterns. That's a rebirth making consciousness if you don't change it. That's a rebirth making consciousness if you don't change it. Fortunately, the wholesome is more powerful than the unwholesome. To say, okay, it's here. I'm going to practice kindness to everybody just for a second. 1 second repeated 3 times a day is more powerful than a whole day. I'll tolerate it. It has more power on the psyche. The wholesome really is more strong than the unwholesome. We really do prefer to be generous. To be mean, miserable, and to being mean, miserable, and sniveling. We really do. Altruism is a much better career choice for all of us. So that's beautiful, you know? And that you actually say, okay, now I'm going to take this, and rather than I'll tolerate it. Okay. I allow myself to tolerate it, and I'm going to use the moment of toleration to practice kindness. You know? I know I'm a repetitive in a lot of ways, and you just have to bear with me because I'm getting old and I can't think of anything new to say. But if you hook an old habit and a new habit together, it's easier. If you want to meditate and you don't make time even to do, you know, half an hour a day or whatever, hook it to whatever it is you drink first thing in the morning. Because pretty well everybody always drinks something in the morning. If you want to establish an old thought, hook it to a new thought. Hook it to an old thought. And the old thought comes up and then you add it. Otherwise, you're going to end up fighting. Oh, I shouldn't have thought that, or, you know, say, okay, oh no, I'll tolerate it. And you notice that there's this little shock there, and I'll use it to practice loving kindness. And then it gets so that whenever I tolerate it comes up, there's also the suggestion that maybe I'll use it to practice loving kindness. And I think I said to you yesterday that is basically Vajrayana, taking your habits and turning them toward the divine. Taking all of the habits and turning them, the power of the habit, to come to clarity and compassion.
Yet the divine is within your grasp. I mean,
it's not separate from where you are.
Yeah.
And it's your habits that block you, and understanding the divine is also the result of an action. Your actions at the moment are to continue to cloak you, to make you feel like you have to continue becoming, you have to, you're not there yet, That same desire to become, you turn it into the desire to become present. Yeah. Habits are basically creating the next moment, which is very similar to the moment before, cause and effect, right? You think this way, this is basically going to be the result, this is how you're going to perceive the world, da-da-da-da-da. You think there's only one chance, all of your mind goes on to that, and you can't see anything else, and when it doesn't come exactly like you want, you feel like an abject failure. You think there is one chance and it's repeated everywhere. Totally different. You think that was one chance. There's one chance and it's already happened and you won. Totally different. It's the same desire. It's just how you're using it. It's the same habit. So you find, you know, find out what your habits are first, which is where I think the pebble is very useful. And again, to quote Linda Stitt, the easy lesson leaves me disdainful. I only pay attention when it's painful. And that's certainly exactly what the pebble does. It makes you pay attention. And it's not somebody else doing it to you, so it really kind of cuts out your ways of, you know, adding evidence, you know. You know how we do that. We love to collect the evidence. Of course, some of us are very inventive about explaining it. Oh, I've got this pebble. I know. Oh, says the professor. Okay. Fits it into something habitual for himself and carries on. Oh, yeah, I've had pebbles in my shoe. Probably middle of the night, he's going to wake up in her sock. How'd it get in her sock? He should, anyway.
Really?
He's a good professor. Wait a minute, how do you get a pebble in your sock? Was there anything else you wanted to?
Well, I just, there were other moments when I fully realized this, well, fully realized rebirth thinking consciousness, that at one point I saw the squirrel in my bird feeder, and I thought, you son of a, you know, get out of there. So I launched, I felt the pebble, I went, and the words came out. Get out of there, that's for the birds. And then I realized that I wanted to turn it. So I said, okay, you can have that grain, but you're not eating that one up there. And I really meant it. He went, he looked at me, and he went down, he jumped off, and he went to the grain on the, yeah, he did it. But it was like...
Now, isn't that interesting?
What?
That he did that.
Mm. He listened to me, and he understood it.
Yeah, that's right. Isn't that just interesting? Mm-hmm. Do you think we're all connected?
Sounds like it.
It's a big jump, I know, but there's certainly something that happened there. Because you could feel it, couldn't you? Mm-hmm. You can see him looking
at me. He was looking at me, and he got down.
And I said, oh, okay.
Down here.
Yeah, he ate some, and then he left. Yeah, it was just like, wow.
That was pretty interesting. I was looking after Rinpoche's house at Kidmount. You know, I'm going to tell stories tonight, so blah, blah, blah. There were mice in it. Mice eat the wiring. He hadn't had it for a year yet. And I lived there for the first 3 years. He was gone most of that time. And he phoned once to see how things were going. Said, well, you have to get a cat. Oh, no, I'm not getting a cat. No, I've had a dog cat. I've had enough pets. No, I can't keep a pet. No cat. Okay, I say, long silence. Do you have good fire insurance? It's a long silence. Okay, but it has to be Burmese, he says. So meanwhile, I've got these live traps going, right? And I've caught quite a few mice, and I've taken them up the road to the dump and let them go there and then come back. But there is, like, one mouse who goes in the live trap like it's his inn, eats all the food, and gets out again. The others couldn't do this. So I'm looking for a Burmese cat. It's very hard to find a Burmese cat in February. That's for sale.
Kidmount.
Kidmount. And, you know, I'm checking all around, trying to find, you know, I'm starting to go, okay, Peterborough, okay, I'm doing the, you know, circle gets wider and wider. And meanwhile, I keep trying all these different things. And then I'm remembering spending some time with Dorothy McLean, who wrote a book called To Hear the Angels Sing, who was the one at Findhorn that was the one who started talking to the Dewas to get the garden to grow and stuff like that. And I'd met her, and I'd done a workshop with her, and I'd take her up to the Dharma Center, and, you know, so... So I'm sitting there, and I'm looking at this one mouse, and he comes, he's quite bold, you know, he jumps, and you know the brick fireplace. He comes running across the room, jumps up on the brick from behind me on this side by the window, jumps up on the brick, runs across the brick, and I think, okay, Dorothy taught me to do this. So I image this platform above my head, or this energy, gold energy above my head, where the spirit of communication of humans is my, that's my telephone connection to the spirit of communication of humans. And I image the spirit of communication of mice around the mouse, and I send a message from here to there to get to him. And the spirit, the communication is, you should just go in that live trap and stay in there, because there's going to be a cat here tomorrow, and this is your last day. And he stops halfway across the brick. He's like got this little ledge. He stops. He rubs his ears.
Oh no!
Rubs his ears. He does his whiskers. He looks around. And then he runs in, and he goes in that live mouse trap. And he eats, and he goes out again. And so, and I put some more food in it. And then, a little while later, he's not around, but I do the thing again. And I do it a third time. And a third time, he comes out, walks across, gets in the live trap, and sits there. I walk over there. This is the mouse that's been going in and out of this live trap for days. I walk over there and I put masking tape on both sides. He could have gotten out. He sits there. It's not until I'm out the door and walking up the road that he starts going chitter chitter and running back and forth and trying the doors. I go up to the dump and I open it up and he runs out. Gone. But I got the cat anyway. Interesting, isn't it? If you actually are trying to communicate to them rather than enjoying your anger. Okay. Rather than doing the habitual. But you actually wonder. And you can't do that unless you're present and you have a wish, right? You know, you've all been around animals, cats or dogs, who've never been raised in a way that they thought that humans talked to them. They were just sort of there. I don't know, I have seen that. But when a cat who has never actually been expected the person to actually say, no, you can't go right now, and be talking to them, just expects them to be making demands and everything is going to be met or not met. And you actually go and you talk to a cat, they just don't hear you. And then all of a sudden one day, if you just keep it up, all of a sudden one day they'll turn around and look at you. Oh my God, she's talking to me. So you just see it like a little ticker tape going through. Oh, this human is communicating. I didn't know humans could communicate.
My grandmother used to do that. She used to, when I was young, she'd always say, you can talk to animals.
Yeah.
And she would do that with ducks and all these sort of
you
things.
Can.
And she's always had the best relationships with animals.
Yeah.
And it's interesting.
And it's true. Yeah. But you actually have to have something to say to them. Mm-hmm. You know? And you can set your limits and their limits. They do that. That's all of what Dorothy McLean did at the garden. Okay, I'll put this here for you. Don't eat this. We need this. Mm-hmm. Then you went over the line. So make sure you keep the food down there for this one.
Got a sculpting machine.
Oh, good.
Oh, it's fun.
What is it?
I've got a skunk in the shed, underneath the shed. I can smell it, and I know I can see the hole. I know he's there, or she's there, because that's where I put my bike. Inwardly, I think I'd be frightened if the skunk came out, but I know it's not going to. And it's like, today I heard myself thinking, you can stay there, but don't come out when I'm in here. It's like, you can stay there. You're okay there. Yeah, it's interesting.
Uh-huh. Anything else to report about that? Did you all do the practice, by the way, once, or read it at least?
The loving kindness practice.
Yeah. Was it interesting?
For me, it was a very different practice because my usual, this is what I did in the morning, the first thing I usually do in the morning is yoga. And so today I sat and went
very different
practice. It was a very different practice. And it was difficult for me to just sit and go through this because it took a long time to. Mm-hmm. And I felt a bit of an anxiousness at some point to kind of finish the truth.
The truth's good.
Yeah, I let it pass.
And it did pass?
And it passed, yeah. And then I got... I allowed myself to get involved in it.
And do you know about what time that was when the restlessness started?
Pretty early on.
About 20 minutes into it?
Yeah, it was probably, maybe 10, 15 minutes into it.
The mind usually does about a 15-minute cycle. Mm. Slightly restless, okay, slowly getting into it. Oh, did I? Oh, yeah, okay. From 5 minutes to 10 minutes, usually slow interest building. 10 minutes is usually starting to be peak, actually involved. And then it starts building up, and then the first restlessness starts about 15 or 20 minutes. So you do 3 cycles of 20 minutes, or a sit, or 3 cycles of the mind like that. Mm-hmm. And so have the pattern that the mind goes in. You watch, you'll see it. And the third time that you get to that focus point, it's deeper. Second time is deeper than the first.
Yeah, because I went through the anxiousness at the first time, so the next time around it was easier to pass through that than I could.
Yeah. How about you?
The meditation, I did something different. I actually put my father there because I know from the stories that I know, I think there was a lot more. My father did a lot of the caretaking when I was little, but so it was a very interesting. It was very different to have him there. It was very nice. I mean, it was very warm, and I really felt that from him because I've always known that the love I have for him doesn't come from my knowledge of him from about 5 or 6 on.
Yes.
But it had to, and there is just enough story. So it was a really wonderful thing to do. So that was
very nice.
And then when I went through it, it was I took more care this week with choosing who
to be for the recipient.
So it was a little different, and it It was good. It was a great way to start the day.
Mm.
And it felt more spacious. I mean, it really was. It was a very spacious sit, which was really great.
And how was the pebble?
Well, the pebble was bigger. I too switched feet, but I did it deliberately. I mean, it was very much, it sort of done enough of one foot.
Was it different from one foot to the other?
Yes, there was way more. Once again, I found there's something about my right foot, or, you know, whatever it is, that I could find more places where I would be comfortable, like that tolerating...
You could tolerate it with the right.
With the right, but with the left, I felt like I spent the second half of the afternoon, I switched at about 1 or 1:30, and I felt so many more moments of stopping, knowing where I was, you know, thinking, am I thinking about something that's beautiful or not beautiful? And going through that, just being able to stop and actually have that thought. Now, sometimes I couldn't distinguish. I couldn't tell if it was beautiful or if it was not beautiful.
Right.
But at least I could be there.
Yeah, exactly. Because sometimes it isn't either.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the story I have for the day is that early in the day I had said something to this my co-worker about looking at things positively as opposed to looking at the negative. It was just so the context. And I got just an email from somebody, and I just went into this. Well, this is mine, and really, he shouldn't have said that, or he shouldn't have thought that, and I could just kill him, you know, I could just strangle him. And she just went, didn't you say something about looking at the positive today?
Isn't that brilliant?
I felt the pebble, and I listened to her, and it just changed the day.
Beautiful.
You know? It was great.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
The power of telling everybody.
Exactly.
They'll remind you. Give you a gift.
Yeah. It was all that. It was really quick payback,
yeah.
Too.
Yeah. Beautiful. Oh, thank you. That's very nice. How about you, Beth?
That was a great day today. Very interesting day. I was walking around taking my first sip of my hot water with lemon in it, and I suddenly realized, you know, this is what I do. I don't pay any attention to what I'm doing. I'm just doing it, and my mind's off somewhere else, and I caught myself, and I went and I sat on the couch where I don't usually sit to drink.
Brilliant.
my lemonade.
And doesn't that change things?
Oh, it did.
Did you find yourself getting restless there?
No.
I always do. I go and sit somewhere else because I'm going to break a habit, and I sit there. And if I'm not really watching, I'll be in my habitual place, or I'll be sitting there going, oh, there's a newspaper around here. I do.
No, I do. Well, maybe tomorrow that might
not.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, but that wasn't the experience for the most part. I watched how the mind would want to go away, but...
Yeah.
I really became very aware of what was going on in the body, and interest really arose for me.
Oh, good.
And so I really actually enjoyed it, but about halfway down the lemonade, I started to get restless.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm just gonna do this right through. So I wasn't altogether there the last part of it.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, I can sit there for about a half a cup.
Yeah, okay.
And then it goes, and then pretty soon I found myself where I didn't even notice I got up and walked on. Okay, yeah, that's enough of that. Okay, we've done something new. Now let's get back to where I feel more comfortable, more familiar. And I don't even see myself do that.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what's shocking to me.
Yeah.
Like, who is in charge? Wait a minute, I thought this was my life. It's fascinating, isn't it?
That's what I found with the pebble. How many times, again, I was very aware of it most of the day. I found it very uncomfortable, so my attention was brought back to it again and again. And I was just by the end of the morning, almost at a point of despair. Something you said last night really, really hit me. You just reiterated, you know, one of the basic tenets there is dissatisfaction or dissatisfactoriness. And it hit me that I think I spend most of my life trying to avoid accepting that. And today that's what it felt like. I don't want to be here just in case it's not comfortable or something. It's just, so I caught myself just time after time after time on my way to do something, not even thinking about it, not even knowing, to the point where part of the way through the morning I found myself going from one thing to the other and not ever reaching any place. It's just like I was wandering around totally out of control. With just barely enough presence of mind every time I became aware of the pebble to see what was going on. How much energy I waste. And then when I could catch it, and it wasn't all the time that I was able to identify whether the mind state was, you know,
beautiful or unbeautiful.
I would do it enough to realize whatever the antidote was, I'd try one or the other. But it always brought me back into my body. And that was the thing about it. You know, when the antidote, when I got the right one, I'd come back into my body. But
you feel centered.
Yeah, I felt centered. And when I could identify the non-beautiful, it was like this sense of shrinking in the body. And the beautiful was like being ahead of my body.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. So.
Exactly.
So that the identify, you know, seeing was the beautiful was a way of just sort of expanding the space and seeing the, you know, and applying the antidote of the non-beautiful was like just coming back into the body.
Mm-hmm.
So I could started to watch the shifts in energy, and so by the afternoon, a lot of what was happening was having identified the despair. The question sort of came up was around what if I'm not constantly driven by escaping the present, what is there? I mean, what else is there?
No, that's a nice question, isn't it?
And so by the afternoon, it was like out of despair I asked it, but it was a real question.
It began to get interesting?
That's what happened. That's what there was. And I remembered this summer of a lot of the retreat work I had done and how interest kept growing and growing and growing and how that kept me in the moment.
Exactly.
And so I was more present throughout the afternoon, and there were many times I would become aware of the pebble, but allow my focus to be more on the pebble and just appreciate it.
Good. Excellent. Yeah. I mean, that is an option when you realize that everything, all conditioned states are dissatisfactory. You can just say, okay, well, I'm gonna just bliss out, pretend that's not true. Mm. Or when I can't do that, I'm gonna blame everybody else. Or I'm gonna take drugs, or I'm gonna commit suicide, or any of those options. Or I'm gonna believe that something over there is actually gonna save me, or any of those options. Or you can actually turn around and start saying, well, what is there? Okay, I accept that. And what is there? And then there is the present moment. And then in the present moment, you can look more closely at what is arising and falling. then you start to say, well, what is the body? You really say that. You don't say it necessarily in those words. But what is that feeling? What is it that communicates to a squirrel? What is mind? That's when you're practicing the four foundations of mindfulness. That's what the four foundations of mindfulness are. Actually wanting to know what it's like to be here. No longer arguing about the circumstance for being here. In order to be here, it's dissatisfactory. And the dissatisfactoriness has three different natures. One of them is actual pain, which you all experience today. From a pebble in your shoe. One of them is change. That nothing stays the way you want it to. And one of them is just the basic truth of maintenance, of becoming, of you never finish anything. You finish one thing and another project is on the other side of it. Anybody who's done renovations in a house knows all about that one. Or cooked a meal. Then there's the dishes. Oh, I'm getting hungry again. Oh, time to go shopping. Oh, I better cook. Oh, there's the dishes. That is ongoing. Grinding, grinding, grinding. Those are the three types of dissatisfactoriness. That's pretty specific, isn't it? That's like, it's stopped. Oh, no, it's going. That's very specific. And to try to either ignore them, and so therefore try to satisfy the becoming one, which is what most of us do most of the time, that's called all-pervasive dissatisfactoriness. That's how its translation comes out. All-pervasive. As soon as there is coming into mind-body, there is a time limit. And if there is a time limit, there's an event that is unfolding. And if there's an event unfolding, it's developed on conditions. And if there are conditions, one event is hooked to the next. And if one event is hooked to the next, as soon as you finish this one, that one's going to start. Or they're all happening at the same time, and your attention will go from one to the other. It's called all-pervasive dissatisfactoriness. Any life form is subject to that, including God realms, the formless realms. To pretend it isn't true or to pretend it isn't dissatisfactory doesn't change it. It is dissatisfactory, but it's true. To never allow yourself to just stop and see it operating and see this dissatisfactoriness, the desire to make something finish. There's a real desire, isn't it? Yeah. To finish something or to do something. And to see that desire, to realize that nothing is ever finished, is almost a superhuman effort. Isn't it? Especially because one of the main ways we actually stop ourselves from going to the despair that we meet when we have this idea that somehow it's our fault that things aren't perfect. And most of us have that idea somewhere as well. So there's a despair that happens when you see the all-pervading dissatisfactoriness. This feeling of like Frank was saying, that beautiful question he asked about what do you do when you realize that you can't do anything? And I went back to overcome the bitterness in your heart, because you're not up to the magnitude of the pain that's been entrusted to you. You know, we are not up to the magnitude of the pain of dukkha. It is all-pervasive. It is vast. I cannot do anything about it, which was why you were going with last night with you. What are you all this for? What are you going to do with it? It's true, I can't. You know, I can't make everybody happy. I can't remove awesome. And so on one hand, that is a stop point if it reflects back only on you. If you make it into a doorway of, well, is there anything besides me? It's the opening to a different understanding. So it's either a doorway or a reason to get more frantic or get bitter. It is either a doorway or a leap in experience. One of the two. Which do you want to use it for? If you continue to think that something or someone is going to save you from the dukkha, at some point you are going to be disillusioned of that. It's better to let this message creep in a little bit so the fall is not so profound. Because we're good at bitterness. Some of us have been perfecting it for lifetimes, haven't we? And at some point it might be, maybe, you know, I am one of many people, maybe, that is giving this little message out to all of us, including myself. And so that maybe at some point in the midst of a throw of bitterness, there will be some part of my being that says, could it also be a doorway? You know, at one point, sometime, someplace, somewhere, some aspect of the consciousness has had enough of bitterness, has had enough of despair, has had enough of trying to be noble beyond all experience, to actually say, could that feeling of helplessness actually itself be the key? Is that what surrender means? Is there a difference between surrender and collapse? The answer is yes. But you cannot ask that question that changes it from surrender, from collapse to surrender, unless you have some balance between like and dislike. Unless you have some way of staying middle while seeing your preferences. You don't have to change your preferences. You don't have to get rid of them. You just have to not be caught by them. Why would you change your preferences? I mean, who has better preferences than you? Bored with it, and I'll say it again. Preference make lousy dictators, but they make excellent friends. Mm. No? Your preferences make lousy dictators. They are the worst characteristic to put in charge of your life. But they make excellent friends. Because you will be enriched by your preferences. But if you're led by them, glub, glub, glub. And surely with this little bit of experience you've had today with the beautiful and the unbeautiful, you get a glimpse of that. Mm-hmm. How if you actually use those two just a little bit, you actually learn how to allow your preferences and not be blinded by them. I think you're fairly good at that anyway.
That's how I felt today.
Yeah, I've watched you.
I'm pretty even.
Yeah, I've watched you for many years and really admired the way you've done that. I don't think you used to all the time, but I don't know where you learned it, but it's one of the qualities about you that I just enjoy so much. So I don't think that for you that was a lot of revelation, but maybe some of the habitual thoughts and things that must have been interesting to you. Because in another way, those are subtle preferences, aren't they? But long-standing, running ones that to actually consider, like, you know, changing the interior color scheme. Change the exterior one, change the interior. And sometimes what we're good at, we have trouble communicating to somebody else who isn't good at it. So maybe it's interesting to you to hear me go on and on about this.
It is. I was very interested in the exercise of the loving kindness exercise, and this first person that one has this feeling for. And the example was, in the Tibetan tradition, was the mother. And I tried, you know, I didn't try very hard, but I did try. And I was basing it on feeling, like a bodily feeling. And I can hardly remember my mother holding me. So it was very hard to make her that figure, you know. And it wasn't like a tearful moment.
No.
It was a physical feeling. And who it was my grandfather, her father.
Oh, for goodness.
And there was that whole sense there. It was really, really nice. When the expectation was lessened, that next relative, then I could make that my mother. Mm-hmm. Isn't that strange?
That's wonderful.
And right behind that thought, or that seeing... was a real sense of the gifts that woman had given me.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I just saw them. Oh my God. She gave me space and she let me play.
Right. What perfect gifts. What perfect gifts.
You know?
Oh God, yeah.
It was quite amazing. So, I was very, very thankful for that exercise, and I want to continue to pursue that.
Right.
You know, because I thought there was so much came out of it, like texturally.
Yes.
You know, it was very, it wasn't a head trip experience at all.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't find my way other than through.
Yeah, yeah, for two reasons.
Yeah.
One, the pebble. Makes you more aware of your body. And two, that's what the exercise is based on. Smell them, remember them, what were they wearing, what, you know. So you're going to go past your habitual thought of who that person was. And you'll, like you said, you had a memory. You will suddenly find, like, all of a sudden, a different quality than you generally think. It's just there.
It was amazingly sensual, actually.
And one's whole sense of space
shifted. Yeah.
It was very, very
interesting.
Were you on that? You were in that group.
Do you
want to
tell people what you experienced?
Well, it started off with meditation, and I could never see my mother before, but this time I saw her twice, but both once as young and once as old, which was odd because I don't know if I ever connected with my mother. And I also saw that I had enemies. When I got to that part, I never felt that I had enemies before. But there are people that you want to stay away from. And there's that feeling. But the thing with the pebble, that's where I got into it. I was walking back from the lobe. I felt the pebble. And, I stopped and it was in the future that I was going to, etc. And then I had this funny feeling of being beside myself. And when I looked up, it was like stepping off of something, and even the horizon seemed to, shift. Just instantaneous like that. But I had these little weird things, there's a couple of trees beside one building, and going through those four or five trees, I just felt like I was in a forest. Just for a second like that. Something changed.
Yeah. Habitual view versus experiential view. What you want to do is have them together. So like the Buddha said, I too use concepts, habitual view. I'm just not fooled by it. Because you want that textural experience of your world and to be able to concept it, to make a habit or need when you need to. You don't want to be overwhelmed when the light turns to amber. You want to be able to use the concept and not have the concept block out the experiential. I'm just delighted with what y'all did with this. It's very nice.
I didn't talk about my experience from the loving kindness meditation. I used my mother for the first part, and I've never put my mother in that position before. There were so many memories that came to me, just little things like her zipping up my snowsuit and the zipper getting caught on my dress. And her licking my ice cream cone so it wouldn't drip, and her lipstick marks being left on the ice cream. Those were the sort of the two main ones. But I was just sort of flooded by all these things she did for me when I was little. And at first, when I thought I'd used my mother, there was this sense of,
this
is risky. But there was, once in a while, something sort of came up, and I thought, well, yeah, that too, but... And then just look for the other thing.
Looking for the kindness.
And there was so much, and it was so rich. And then I sort of looked at my notes when I got through her, read through the notes, and I thought, oh yeah, I have to do it for all these other people. And there was such a sense of relief that I could share it with others.
Beautiful.
And not have to sort of keep it in categories. But however, there was the experience when I got to the person with whom I had difficulties that it was a little harder to do.
Yeah.
But it was quite interesting. Who I chose is actually a friend. And I keep wondering, what the hell am I doing with this person as a friend? Because there are just so many ways we push each other's buttons. But when I concentrated on what I felt she gave to me, there was so much. And it's like the other parts didn't matter.
Right.
Just like with my mother. The other parts didn't matter.
Yeah.
So
when loving kindness is fully developed, it becomes the awareness of boundless beauty. You can see the beauty in everything. You can see the quality of the beautiful no matter where you look. So the Navajo saying, which I often use for people on retreat as a walking practice. Now I walk in beauty. It's a very nice mantra to say during your day, with or without a pebble. Now I walk in beauty, and just have a sense of being in beauty. Beauty is before me, I imagine that whatever it is you're moving into is supported by beauty. Beauty is behind me. Whatever it is that's been in the past is flooded with beauty. Or kindness. There's no difference between beauty and kindness in the energy in our bodies. There's no difference. The ability to perceive the beautiful in this way of kindliness without losing your intelligence is the basis for faith.
Could you say that again?
The ability to perceive the beautiful without losing your intelligence is the basis for faith. Because you cannot trust unless you like. And the best way to like is viscerally, and that's what beauty does. It's a visceral experience. Just like the touch of someone when you were very young was very visceral. And that's why you invoke it, and that's why you invoke it through the body, which is what I've been aiming at with this exercise. Any questions?
So are we carrying on with this exercise?
Well, you could if you want. I mean, it's certainly powerful and worthwhile. And I think it's certainly worth you doing more. Or I could add another step to it. It's up to you. I give it to you. Because I could add the other step tomorrow night if you want. If you want to stay with this, I think it's worthy. But I also am quite willing to go further. Like, from my point of view, this exercise is worth about 3 months. Mm-hmm. Also from my point of view, I leave on Sunday.
Yeah.
You want me to tell you more, or do you feel full? You know? Like, yeah. I'm happy to leave you guys seated, but... So, is that everybody's vote?
Yeah.
More.
More, please.
Yes, more. I'm just going to read this little bit of this. This is actually very beautiful, but it might sound very dry to you. If you actually work with each paragraph of it, it gets very profound. And this is called The Three Principles of the Path, and it's Tsongkhapa, Jie Tsongkhapa, who is one of the great saints of Tibetan Buddhism. He actually is the one who... is the sort of the root of the Dalai Lama's Sankhilupa. And why he is the root is really interesting. He was a brilliant kid, probably as obnoxious as all get out to his parents. You know how brilliant kids could be like that. And and also intellectually brilliant, and also extremely powerful in terms of charisma and magnetic energy. So he was trained in his time a lot of the sort of more what we now often consider those of us who are so, you know, such connoisseurs of Tibetan Buddhism, more the Nyingma tradition of the Nyingma kind of and Karyu kind of tradition of the magical, you know, the energies, right? Which was very unusual because his first training was more traditional, because after Buddhism was introduced in Tibet, and it was the Nyingma school, and then after a certain few hundred years, then there was a king that came into power who really preferred the Bon tradition, the old tradition, and made war on Buddhism and basically wreaked havoc, and very similar to what has happened since 1959. It destroyed virtually all the monasteries, killed lamas, forced them to marry each other. It did all the same things. It's basically a repeat. That's interesting, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And he was assassinated. But it took a couple of hundred years for Buddhism to be reintroduced. When it was reintroduced, one of the ways it was reintroduced was... Do you all know this? Is this boring to you? You don't know this? Oh, okay. So after about 150 years or so, then the Tibetans started saying, well, you know, the Nyingma, you see, the tradition of meditation and passing on knowledge had sort of disappeared because so many texts were burned and everything. So there was still a strong sense of what to do and sort of a partial understanding of the meditations, but not the whole system. This is the story that's told. And so it had deteriorated, the teaching had deteriorated to being, according to some people, part pure Buddhism, part superstition. You know, right? And so then it was decided, okay, well, we got to change this, so... So then a bunch of young men were selected to make their way, who had the right kind of qualifications to be good monks. Didn't send any women, because women wouldn't have made it across the mountains. It was a dangerous trip. And so these young men were selected and sent across the mountains to go to the great monastery and to study Buddhism and become ordained. So... Actually, 7 or 8 of them made it back and brought texts, and then more were sent, and then more were sent, and then eventually enough were sent that then there was, and then there were real translations, and then there were the first real ordinations by Tibetans, of Tibetans, and then there were the schools, and at this time there was like very strong dedication. This was basically the Shakya school. Very strong dedication to keep the law, to study the Dharma. This was very precious. We mustn't fall back into magic. So then the Shakyas are known as the rules. You know, if you do anything with the Shakyas, you have to really keep the rules. You'll hear that, you know. Well, the name was, yeah, but they tend to be sort of superstitious, you know. Right? There are these, have you noticed? There are these little superstitions about each other. Have you noticed this? No? I guess you're just pure. Not like me. You don't travel between the schools like I do you? So then there was the Kargyus who felt that, you know, yes, but we shouldn't need to study so much. We need to put more focus, because the monks came back and began to Kargyu. Had spent more time meditating. Well, you should be able to focus more on meditation, and, you know, like, study should be supplementary, but the Shakyas were study, meditation, equal. Okay, you're meditating on that, you also have to study it. Okay, you're studying that, you also have to meditate on it. This is the rule, do it this way. But, you know, like, transmission, the whispered teaching. Argue. Whisper. Whisper. I'll give you a hint. Go work it out. Very kind of you. Does that remind you of anything? So, no, don't ask for help. And then, so here along comes Jason Kappa, and here's this guy, and he's, like, brilliant. So he gets all the training, and he aces, he does all the three-year retreats on all of the Shakya and all the Kagyu stuff. He just aces it left, right, and center. He's got all the texts memorized, as he can jot and diddle with the best of them. Debate, ace. What does he do? He goes and studies with those damn nameless. Well, yeah. They learn how to keep ghosts in check. And, you know, I don't see the text here on how to keep ghosts in check. And he actually, then everybody's waiting because he's been trained by everybody now. And they're saying, like, well, okay. Oh, great, Jay Tsongkhapa, because he's obviously the second Buddha and all that stuff. Well, let's get him in our school. Oh, great, Jay Tsongkhapa, will you please come here and start? We give you this 500,000 disciples and start a monastery. We'll build it any way you want to. Please, come to us. And he keeps finding a way that he doesn't actually accept any of these gifts, and he always, no, but he doesn't insult anybody. He's really very clinically astute, this guy. He's got, you know, more than one pippin of a trick up his sleeve. That's to quote one of my favorite French poets. And so eventually he makes the great statement, because the pressure is mounting from every side, and he says, okay, what I'm going to do is next, I can't remember the time of year, but there's this particular time of year when such and such and such and such, I am going to go to this place, and he names a place that is not anyone's school and visited by all three. And actually debate and had started then, but it wasn't like it. And I would like to have all of you meet there. And that became the great debate, the great council, the great prayer meeting, the great celebration. And that's what Jay Tsongkhapa did. He integrated the three schools.
Wow.
And it's held every year in Tibet since that time. Until 1959, and then it's held in India. Jay Tsongkhapa was a very great teacher, a very great being. And that's where the gang goes.
How do you spell his name?
J-E means it's an honorific.
Uh-huh.
And it's sometimes, and it's spelled T-Z-O-N-G. And sometimes it's K-A-P-A, and sometimes it's K-H-A-P-A. Jay Tsongkhapa.
Where does that fit in relation to Naropa and Milarepa?
Naropa and Milarepa are, well, Milarepa is Kagyu lineage. So
I meant historically.
Well, historically, he is after them.
Mm. Was he before the Dalai Lamas?
Yeah.
So, okay, so in that period.
Yeah. So I will explain as well as I am able the essence of all the teachings of the Concord. The path praised by the Concords and their spiritual children. The entrance for the fortunate ones who desire liberation. So as well as he can, that's what he's going to explain to us. And you notice his language is very simple. He also talks about the most profound different, you know, there's 16 categories of void nature, of emptiness. And he actually does, in various books, talks about them. And there is still that elegance and simplicity of language in it. If you have to read those things, read them by Tsongkhapa. Listen with clear minds. Isn't that nice? Mm-hmm. That's a nice little instruction, isn't it?
That sounds so simple.
Listen with clear minds. I just think that's really nice. Just the idea of it. It's just like clears my mind right away. I just think that's really neat. Sometimes I get up in the morning, I look in the mirror, and I say, listen with clear mind. What a good idea. Oh, what a good idea. Listen with clear mind. So you see, sometimes it takes me a long time when every once in a while I decide I should read this every morning, and it can take me like an hour and a half to read this 2 pages. So I go, oh yeah, listen with clear mind. Oh. You don't care. You fortunate ones who direct your minds to the path. Because there are very few beings who can direct their minds to the path. So he isn't saying those of you born in North America. He's not saying those of you are upper class, middle class, lower class. He's not saying you're pink, green, red, yellow, or white race, or, you know. He's not saying animal, vegetable, mineral. He's saying you listen with clear minds, you fortunate ones, who direct your minds to the path, pleasing to the Buddha. That's pretty neat. I like that. I'm willing to try that. And strive to make good use of leisure and opportunity. See, he doesn't say you have to always be in leisure, or you have to be a monk or a nun. Strive to make good use of leisure and opportunity. Without being attached to the joys of cyclic existence. Without getting caught in becoming. Pleasures that, you know, go to Hawaii once a year and spend the rest of the year paying for the trip. For you embodied beings bound by the craving for existence, without the pure determination to be free from this ocean of existence. So that's about 99% of my time. There is no way to pacify the attractions to its pleasurable effects. You're going to keep being seduced by it. If you don't work at renunciation, you're going to keep being seduced by it. If it's important to you, you have to find some way to bring it into your life. A pebble in the shoe, a note on your computer, because there are more ways to make you forget it than there are to bring it into your consciousness. That's pretty straightforward. Now this guy is saying this, you know, a few hundred years ago, and it's just as true. So this must be a condition that happens to people everywhere. He's in another country, surrounded by Buddhists. He's actually talking mostly to monks. In monasteries. Oh, if I only lived in a monastery, I could complain about that. Thus, from the outset, seek to generate a determination to be free. That's what renunciation is, a determination to be free. It isn't that you don't want to have anything. It's that you've had enough of blind craving. You realize that no matter how much you eat, you will never be satisfied. So would you like to find out, you know, with giving yourself enough to eat, how to move the mind, that desire, to something that might satisfy? Is there something that can be satisfied? So renunciation means to turn your determination to see what can be liberated, not to get stuck on what can't. There is dissatisfactoriness. Don't get stuck on it or get stuck in rebelling about it. There is kindness. There is the experience of love. There is many gifts. These things are true. We have received enormous support, even if we don't remember it as our favorite bedtime story. It is there. It is visceral. It's real. Change the space in which you habitually conceive of yourself, and other selves will begin to speak. Can't find the power in this self? Change the self. It will be there. It will be there. I guarantee it. So, knowing that, then you can start to say, all right, by contemplating the leisure and endowments so difficult to find and the fleeting nature of your life, right? Precious human birth and impermanence, right? Over and over and over again, by recognizing what you do have in the moment that supports you to practice kindness, and that you don't know whether you're going to have it 5 minutes or not, now from not. You do not or not. You do not know that. You think you know that, but you really do not. You really do not know when you are going to live or when you are going to die. You really don't have a clue whether you're going to make it through those trees. There is no way to know. Wake up. Wake up. Be present. Okay, and what do you have at the moment, other than what you're trying to get or you're trying to get away from? What do you have in the moment? Isn't that something? Reverse the clinging to this life of endless desire. It isn't that you're not still in it. You're not clinging to it. You're not trying to satisfy. Again, you see, you're not changing anything but your perception. You can still be acting the same way, but it's your perception that has to shift. You have to actually admit what you already know and take it seriously. Somebody said to the Buddha, you know, why don't you teach? He said, it's too simple. Nobody will believe me. Well, it's true, you know. Who's going to believe this? Okay, what does Buddhism teach? Well, it teaches that life's impermanent, yeah? Yeah, so? We all know that. No, we don't. No, we don't. We all make a point of not knowing that. We all know becoming. We all know desire. We all know dissatisfactoriness and then trying for the next. That we know. We know it very well. Know how to look at that and decide not to do it and allow other realities to begin to emerge. Ooh, don't want to go there. Because I can't do anything about it. That's the point. I can't do anything about it. What happened with that loving kindness? At a certain point, you're aware of all beings and you realize you wish them to be free of suffering. And what? I I can't, I isn't there, number one, when you really wish that. And the second thing is, then you start thinking, okay, how do I do that? And I can't. That's right. That's true. I cannot. See, I is what has to change. Perception of I has to change. Perception of I can change if you have other experiences of I. You can't have other experiences unless you're here. When you're here, memories that you had not included in your CV that gets slightly adapted and passed out at every opportunity. Come in. So what you have to do, and this is amazing, you have to reverse the clinging to future lives. Reverse that desire to keep going. Still gonna, always in the middle, always, you know. Yeah. Reverse that desire to think that the mill is actually gonna do something. It is gonna do something. It's gonna continue the mill. And meanwhile, is there anything else? Okay, I will still continue with the cyclic existence, but how do I maintain an awareness of the question of, is there another level? Because that's what Buddhism says. That's what every teaching says.
It'd be real suffering if you were a control freak, wouldn't it?
It is. It is real suffering. Absolutely. Because you can never let go. Mm-hmm. I think that's what many politicians are caught in. I'm glad that so many of them are ethical. But there's a sense that they can do something. I would not want to be in that job. I think it's very important for some people to be in positions of power and authority where they have to interact with other people in power and authority. Because I think some people need a very big arena to actually be able to see themselves. Does that make sense to you? I think there's some people that really cannot perceive themselves, feel almost like they're nothing, or can't quite conceive of themselves, until they're in a job with a vast scope, and then they begin to appreciate themselves. Mm-hmm. And then they can start saying, so what is this self going to do? Mm-hmm. Is that better? There's lots of different types of people in the world. They're not all simple and greedy like me. Very straightforward.
Can I ask what you're reading from?
This is a prayer book from Angelupa Center that I went to and did a retreat at once. This is first prayer book. Called Pearls of Wisdom, and this is just like the little morning meditations. It's, if you want to look up their website, they have a brilliant website, and it's called the FPMT.
Oh.
FPMT. And I think if you just even put FP is Foundation for the Preservation of the Mahayana Tradition.
Yes.
And it's Lama Geshe and Lama Zopa started it.
And they have a magazine now.
And they've had a magazine for years, and they have a brilliant website. And I think if you just look under Buddhism and anything that has FPMT, or Foundation for the Preservation of the Mahayana Tradition. And also they put out a calendar.